Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another great Saturday morning here. We have a Suspense Radio. Glad you guys can all join us today. My name is John Robb. I'm your host. Today's show, we got a great show for you today. We're going to have authors Johnny Shaw on. He's going to be first, and then J.M. LeDuc is coming on to talk about their books. So we got an action-packed show here, 60 minutes. It's all coming your way. So sit back, relax, and enjoy, because you know 60 minutes starts right now. So again, it's great to have everybody here this morning, this great Saturday morning of Suspense Radio back after a couple week hiatus. You can go back and listen to all the shows here, blogtalkradio.com/suspensemagazine. If you don't have the September issue of the magazine, email editor at suspensemagazine.com to get all the insights. We've got a great lineup coming up in October, November, December. You're going to see in the magazine, you're going to see the likes of Kathy Reichs, you're going to see Lee Child. You're going to see Barry Eisler. You're going to see Iris Johansson, possibly Dean Koontz, and many others are going to be interviewed and looked in the magazine, excerpts, books. We got a bunch of stuff coming on. We're changing things up. Looking forward. December 2010, as you know, is our best of 2011. That's our best of magazine to recap the entire year, tell you which were the books. Send out our awards, let everybody know what's, you know, what was the best for 2011. But right now, we're going to transform over to our first guest. His name is Johnny Shaw. You can find him at johnnyshaw.net about his latest book, first book called Dub Season. Straight from Boucher County, St. Louis, Johnny is talking to us. So, Johnny, how you doing? Thanks so much for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me on the show, John.
So, yeah, we just talked a little bit off here about BoucherCon, which is a great event for new authors and bigger name authors, too, to go out there and meet the fans and things like that. So you're out there with Dub Season, you know, doing your book and talking about it. So tell everybody a little bit about Dub Season, you know, how it got started, the whole nine yards. Give us the insight.
Okay, yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm a little hoarse because BoucherCon is. I mean, I've had the opportunity to talk to such amazing writers here. So my voice is actually this deep, but it's also a little scratchy right now. Dub Season tells the story of my character, the beginning of a series of Jimmy Veeder. He's kind of a 30-year-old ne'er-do-well, I don't know, like a slacker. You know, he really has no direction. He returns home to his hometown where he hasn't been in 12 years on the Mexican border in the California desert, the Calexico-Mexicali border, which is right on the edge of Arizona. And because his father is dying, he has cancer, so he goes down to spend time with him and to take care of the farm and the house. And his father asks him to do him a favor, and so he jumps at the chance. The favor is his father asks him to find him a prostitute. So he wrangles his buddies together, his old high school buddies, and they head down south of the border and on this quest to find Jimmy's dying dad, a hooker, and kind of all hell breaks loose from there.
Now,
the rest is, I don't want to give it away. It's too great.
Yeah. And so you set the book in a war zone kind of area, which is right now, which a lot of people might realize that the drug cartel and everything that's going on from Mexico into the Arizona-California border, Texas and New Mexico. I mean, we're talking it's a war zone area. And you grew up kind of raised around that area. You know, how difficult is it to, I guess, kind of do the, you know, maybe do the research, do all those things, because it's such a scary time right now living in those areas of the country.
Yeah, I mean, what I think each border town has its own personality and its own problems. Down there on the Calexico and Mexicali, because the American side is the population is so small and it's so agricultural that I think Calexico has maybe 25,000 people, 20,000 people. I mean, I grew up on a farm way outside of town, but Mexicali has over 1 million people. It's twice the size of Tijuana. It's the capital of Baja del Norte, and to the bull ring and the, you know, that the but it's actually, of the border towns, I think it's the least violent. I mean, it's still, it has its problems, but it's always had a strong middle class. And then being able to show Mexico in kind of an honest way and not say it's this, like Juarez and Tijuana have far bigger problems. And I kind of wanted to tell a story that wasn't about, like, drug running or gun running. I wanted to talk about kind of both daily life and the way it's actually, there's a kind of business of exploitation of how people are exploited because of the illegal immigrants that want to come over, want to work, or and the desperation that's coming out of that country. And writing a border town isn't the same as writing about Mexico, if that makes sense, because it's so distinct that the really, there's nothing delicate. I'm going to use the word delicate, and there's really nothing delicate about my book. But border towns, to me, they consistently fulfill stereotypes. Like, what you think a border town is, a lot of times that's exactly what it is. But from a writer's point of view, if you just stick with those stereotypes, you're kind of in, like, kind of well-trod territory where you've seen it that way before. And I felt like I had the opportunity growing up down there. I grew up on a farm. My only neighbor was a field worker bar across the street, you know, where the field workers came. I used to go over there, and they would give me, like, when I was, like, six, they would give me, like, bottles of 7-Up, and they put salt around the rim of the bottle. That kind of maybe set me up for the future. But there's rich details down there, and I saw it as a place that just had, there's people that I trust implicitly. I mean, it's just like, it was my home, you know. So I think it took me 20 years to really see that it was actually exotic in any way.
Now, your character in the book, Jimmy Veeder Fiasco, has to do something a little bit different. Just like you say here on your website, johnnyshaw.net, people click on books, and it says it kind of around the thing, is that his father asked him for a Mexican prostitute. Nothing wrong with that. But there's got to be something behind that a little bit, because that's, you know, as far as in the story, because that's just not something that a lot of people see every day, is the dying wishes for a Mexican prostitute. So what kind of was behind, I guess, the, you know, the creation of that aspect of the book?
Well, that's actually interesting because, yeah, when I was originally writing it, there was one of the early drafts. I don't even think it was the finished first draft, but in early draft, there was the story of Jimmy going down to see his father, and then the story of him and this prostitute. They didn't come together. And there was one point I said, like, what if his father asked him? And as soon as I explored that, I saw that that was something I hadn't seen before. It was original approach. It created all sorts of questions, and questions are always more interesting than answers in a book. That, and also, you know, I have to, you put your mind into a character, every character. And my feeling was, as soon as I thought of that, and I was saying, like, hey, you know what, if I'm dying, that's not a bad idea, you know? Like, too often we look at people that are fighting cancer or fighting diseases, and we look at them as dying people rather than people that are living, kind of struggling with the, you know, with death, you know, with death in their, you know, that you can't start talking about those people in the past tense, you know, that it's something that there's no reason that they can't have at least some level of vitality regardless of what they're struggling against. And so when he asked him, it was true to character. It was and honestly, it shaped the whole rest of the story. And any time when you have two parts of a story that are divided and you can bring them together, it's just going to be tighter, and it's going to create a momentum. But it became the hook of the story, and that wasn't what I intended from the beginning. So.
Now, I had heard a quote one time that I thought was, at first, was I thought was puzzling, and then when I thought about it, it was very true, is that the first book, and this is your first book, is easier to get correct than the second book, and the reason is because you kind of had your whole life to do the first one, but then when you get signed, the second one's due in a year, so you got to kind of get it all together. You don't have those time, you have the time constraints coming at you right now. Was that kind of the same thing that you're feeling now? How long was Duck Season in the works before you finally got it signed here through, you know, Amazon Encore, and now you're kind of feeling the pressure of having to, you know, do the next one, and it's kind of being a little bit more within a restrictive timetable?
Right, yeah, way to put pressure on me.
Right.
What if I wasn't even thinking about that before? I was like, I'll just do it now. I'm like, oh, wow, now I have to put some... I've been a writer for about 15 years, but I was a screenwriter and a playwright, so I have... I joked with somebody last night. I said, I have more discipline than talent. Like, you know, like, I'm the guy that shows up every day and I get the work done. But when I wanted to attempt to write a novel, and I'm not coming up from it, I've written one short story in the last 20 years, that, like, I'm coming up from a different form, from screenwriting and from a longer form, so I'm comfortable with a longer structure and everything like that. So when I sat down, and this is going to sound idiotic, but it's true, I said, like, oh, I want to teach myself how to write novels, so I'm going to write 5 novels in 5 years. That was my plan.
Okay.
Which, that shows you how dumb I am. Dove Season was the first of those 5 novels, and I wrote it in a year because I felt like that's what I wanted to do, and it wasn't rushed. I wrote the first draft in a period of time. I'm a huge rewriter, so it's gone through multiple drafts. And when it got done, the day I finished is also the day I started my next one. So that one's almost done. And that was I already had the first draft done before Amazon picked up Dove Season. So I didn't have a lot of that pressure simply because there was no gap. That's not how I work. Like, as soon as I finish something, I move right. I mean, that day I move on to the next thing. So for me, I have a lot of discipline in that capacity. So I wanted to be already able to write at that kind of pace. So it probably took me more like 15 months, to be honest. But, like, it wasn't something that was, like, it was a story I'd been thinking about as a film, but it worked better in my mind as a novel. So there were parts of the story that existed, but now it wasn't really until I sat down to do it. I guess I might make other writers angry, but it was, you know, I did. I wasn't even planning on shopping anything around until the third or fourth book because I was like, I got to hit my stride. But I really liked how the season turned out, and partly because it was personal, partly I could play to my strengths from the other mediums, like dialogue or momentum, pace. And then by setting it where I'm from, I was really kind of, I could see it very clearly in my head. I mean, there's locations, a lot of locations, names are changed. Some aren't, some, you know, it depends. But it didn't matter. I could see, I could tell you, I could bring you on a tour of that book. Because whether it's, I mean, there's some stuff I made up, but for the most part, you at least visually see the places, even if they're totally different in terms of how they're treated in the story. And same with the people. Yeah, most of the characters in the story are amalgams of people I know.
Now, I've been writing a couple blogs here and about a certain subject, which is pretty much throwing your emotions into your work and discovering maybe, you know, your fears and your anxieties and things like that and making it very emotional. So when the reader reads it, they can feel that same kind of, you know, whether or not it's the same kind of emotion that you were feeling, they can feel some kind of level of emotion, you know, whether they love, hate, you know, sad, angry, whatever it is. What do you think the reader emotionally, when you wrote Dove Season, is going to get out? What kind of emotional roller coaster are you going to take them on through, you know, the 350, 400 pages that you have down here in the book? What is your goal to get the reader to do?
Oh, it will be a roller coaster. I'm fascinated. I feel like in life, too often, in particularly in too often in crime and genre fiction, tone remains the same in a lot of books, where it's like, oh, this is a dark book, so it's dark all the way through, or it's a humorous book, so this book is going to be kind of madcap or goofy all the way through. And to me, that's not a depiction of life. Like, everyone's laughed at a funeral, and they don't know why. Like, that you can in the course of the day, you can feel the full range of emotion. So why not, in a novel, be able to, I mean, it takes kind of a confident hand, or maybe just a hand that doesn't know any better, that to be able to kind of make some kind of dramatic tone changes. So, but it all comes down to some level of empathy that the reader has for the character. If the people, the characters are believable, the setting
right.
is believable, and they react consistently. Like my character, my main character, Jimmy Beter, someone wrote an article about it, and they were saying he's not as smart as I am. Like but you understand why he does things, because he does things based on emotions and a moral code. He's not Sherlock Holmes. He's not using his brain first, but he has kind of a moral code that's going to dictate, just like a soldier has to follow the orders regardless of what they think or feel about it. He has this code that's going to drive him first, and a lot of that code is going to be based on what he feels is right. So the emotions he feels throughout it hopefully it's the full range of emotions. The book, I think, there's a lot of really funny stuff in it. But there's also a lot of violence. There's a lot of darkness. I mean, people die in it.
Mm-hmm.
There's things that, yeah, I mean, it really, like, but they can happen one after, like, I really felt like if you want to take a reader on that journey and you want to have a story that it's still within the genre and it has momentum and has fun scenes, but it also just, it captures life if you can kind of move around. Like, a lot of times in a book, the funny guy will be funny and glib throughout. And that's just not the way people are. People understand context. So, like, I wanted the funny guy that could be very funny, but when the situation got serious, he would turn serious, because
mm-hmm.
that's what people do. I mean, if you want to write an original crime novel, I think you just make the people actually act like real people. If you or I find a dead body, we're not going to make a glib comment about it. I mean, we're going to be like, oh man, like what? It's going to be this thing we can't unsee, and that we have to. You know, that's going to shape us from that point on. And so, if you can write about that honestly, I think a reader can really respect that, and it can still be entertaining. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think it can be about something and it can be entertaining.
Now, when you look at your journey here coming up, when you, like you said, you want to do the 5 books in 5 years, you got Dove Season, and then you decided to go ahead and shop it, and you got picked up by Amazon Encore. You know, kind of let me know, what was the difference kind of feeling something from screenwriting and now into novels, and now you're at Amazon Encore? You know, how did that feel? A lot of authors have never been able to reach that sensation yet of being picked up by a publisher. How did you feel when Amazon Encore said, yeah, we love your work and we want to, you know, we want to represent you and do it?
I mean, it's great. I mean, I went through the process of the publication was I wrote the book, and I was querying agents and getting the book out there, the manuscript out there. And I was getting there, you know, it was moving forward, but nothing was happening. I wasn't being completely ignored, but I was also, you know, that's a tough route. And so I entered the book in Amazon's Breakthrough Novel Award contest. I think that's what it's called, Amazon Breakthrough Novel Award. And that was just because it was free and somebody told me about it. The manuscript was done to a place where I was happy. So it took me like 15 minutes to, you know, enter it, send it, and whatever. And then I kind of just forgot about it. And then people would call me and say, like, oh, you made it to the next round. You made it to the next round. And I made it all the way to the finals. I think 10,000 people entered that contest, and it was the final three in the general fiction category. So I think that's obviously where it's like I got attention from not just Amazon, but I got attention from other places and agents. You know, that kind of exposure. I think that's what really led to everything else. And then eventually I got the call from Amazon. And it's not like even, I mean, I'd met some people through the contest and some more people were aware of my book. The people were still not, they weren't knocking my door down. So when Amazon made me the offer, I was aware of Amazon Encore and what it was. But I was still kind of wary. I used to own a used bookstore, so there's obviously some things in there between bookstores and Amazon, which I didn't feel, but I was just like, I wanted to, you just want to be careful. And so I contacted a couple, three authors that had been with Encore, had their book published, had it out, and just asked them what their experience was. And they couldn't have spit, from an author's point of view, they just spoke about it as the most author-friendly place they ever worked. And they were people that had deals with the Big Six, or, you know, they had something that was comparative. And that's the experience I've had, that my expectations were one thing, and they exceeded my expectations of what they were going to do for my book and what they were going to kind of control, that they were going to allow me both creatively in the text of the book. But I also had a lot of say in the cover and some of the marketing. Like, I've been directly involved with a lot of things, and that's kind of unprecedented. And
yeah, it is.
That really impressed me. And because there was, in some ways, you could say there's no reason they had to do that. That it wasn't necessarily advantageous. It's probably even more work to have to get emails from me. You know, I wrote like a 2-page manifesto about like what I don't like about book covers and what I like about, I mean, it was ridiculous. Anyone else would have thrown it away. And then when they showed me the cover, it was like, you did everything I asked, you know, that impressed me. I mean, I know it's just a cover of a book, but it really impressed me because they had no reason, they had no obligation to do it. There was nothing,
yeah.
There was no obligation. And that meant a lot. And obviously, when I came on to Amazon Encore, that's obviously growing and they continue to grow. There's Barry Eisler and Goldberg, you know, as they continue to grow, I felt like I was on the ground floor or something. They'd recently hired more people, so it really felt, just in terms of the way the work, the day-to-day working, that it felt like kind of an, I know it's not an indie, but it felt like it was operating kind of like a small press, but
mm-hmm.
with the reach of Amazon behind it, you know. And that kind of like marketing and voice and getting that book. I mean, I honestly, when I, like I said, I got to meet Daniel Woodrow, who's kind of a hero to me because there's only a few of us writing rural crime fiction. And he's kind of, you know, he's big to anybody that's doing that. He's amazing. He wrote Winter's Bone. If people don't know, he's great. Read it. And he, you know, I was able to talk to him and I introduced myself, I said, I'm Johnny, and he's like, you write Dove Season? You know, just the fact that he knew it existed, and his ears probably to the ground, but that was, I called my wife, you know, I was like, that's amazing, you know, and I don't know if I could have done that with other people, like, I have nothing, I mean, everyone's experience is different, everybody obviously has different deals and whatever, but I don't know, it's about connecting writers to readers, and Amazon, booksellers, publishers, agents, those are all, I don't call them middlemen because that has a bad connotation, but they're all conduits to create that connection. They're all there to connect the writer to the reader, and I feel like Amazon's doing that really well. And I still shop at independent bookstores, and I love independent bookstores. The one thing that a lot of people aren't talking about is that idea of the independent bookstore and book culture and this being a part of the community, that's kind of a city problem that I didn't grow up with. That. Like, we had to get mail order if we wanted anything except for Louis L'Amour or some executioner books. Amazon actually creates variety for the rural community. You can get things that you wouldn't dream of getting I'm not just saying Amazon. I'm saying the whole it doesn't have to be Amazon. I'm not pushing that.
Yeah, it can be the whole e-book phenomenon.
Yeah, Abe Books, Libris, Biblia, like any of the used book sites. That the idea that you have that kind of accessibility now in the country that you only had in the city before,
right.
I can't see that as anything but a good thing. If I'm in Juneau, Alaska, I'm jumping up and down with joy at the idea of the e-book and a lot of e-tailing in terms of book selling. Yeah, maybe not in New York when you got the Strand or whatever, you know, but when you're out
right.
in the middle of nowhere, where I think that's a forgotten idea of the kind of revolution that's happening. And obviously the dust hasn't settled, but I think it's something actually interesting, and I don't think there's any reason to approach it with fear.
Well, we're talking here with Johnny Shaw, author of The Dove Season. JohnnyShaw.net is his website to read about what's going on. Talking to us right now, he's at BoucherCon in St. Louis. So I got a question real quick here for you, but with BoucherCon, now that you're an author and, you know, maybe you've been to, and you've maybe never been to a BoucherCon before as a fan, but now that you're an author and you're going there and you're looking around, how much of time is spent on yourself as being a fan and being able to see, you know, maybe Lee Child or Michael Connelly and these people just walking around that have, you know, are mega successes? Do you find yourself still becoming a fan? And, you know, have you met the one author that you wanted to meet, right, you know, at BoucherCon?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm not even – one. Also, the word author is still kind of weird to me. Like, I still always am just a writer. But, no, I'm here almost entirely. I don't even have books here. I didn't even bring books.
Oh.
Like, I didn't I came here.
But you got, like, little cards to pass out to tell people, though. You got
cards
and
the people. I did a panel, and I had – but it really – that wasn't – this was not, like – for me, this was not a sales thing. This was about introducing myself to a community, and it was about meeting people that I do think are doing incredibly interesting work, or both the younger crowd and an older crowd. And I had been at Book Expo in May as well, so I had the opportunity to meet some people there, so to see some people again. And no, I'm here as completely as if I don't, like, even though I wrote a book, and yeah, I am, you know, talking to people about it, but I'm way more interested in the people that are here than books about myself. That I'm a total nerd for crime fiction. So when, you know, Daniel Woodrell or Frank Bill or like just anybody that I think is doing really interesting work, or is like John Lutz or somebody who's been around, I mean, there's something to be learned from that, but there's just also something, I don't know, you almost get starstruck, you know, that there's people that their work impresses you. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very easy. I mean, when we first went, you know, we'd go around and we got starstruck the first time we went. Now we kind of go around and it's much different because, you know, we've been to 4, 5, 6 different events and we've been able to talk to these people. And now, you know, it's just like one big happy community, which is a good thing. So, but to wrap it up here, though, I want to know, when you said you had 5 books, I want to know, is Jimmy Veeder in the next ones? What you got for the plans of Jimmy and everything else coming up in the future with your writing? What can people expect?
The one I'm finishing up right now, which is called Big Maria, is not with Jimmy Veeder. It's still set in kind of the same area. It's in the Chocolate Mountains of Arizona and Blythe, California. You know, it's set in the same region. But when I finished Dove Season, I was shopping it around. It seemed a little presumptive to write the second book. So I decided I had an idea for a standalone. So it's just the next book, Big Maria, is a standalone novel. And then I have 2 more Jimmy Veeder fiascos, as I like to call them, in my head. And so I'll immediately – I've already started the second one, which is called Plaster City. And I don't have any dates or anything for when, but that's what, I mean, my Dove Season came out on Tuesday, you know, like it came out 3 days ago or 4 days ago. So I'm still kind of riding that way, but I'm doing the work. You know, I wrote this morning, you know, I have a standalone, and then I'll go back to writing probably the next 2 Jimmy Veeder stories, which will be tied loosely, or at least thematically, to Dove Season.
Right.
I'm a fan of short series, so.
I'm with you. I'm so with you on that one, Johnny. And it was such a pleasure to have you on. We can't thank you enough. Wish you nothing but major success here with Duff Season and going forward. Stay in touch with us so we can stay in touch with you and finding out, you know, what's coming up, you know, more in the future when your next books come out. Love to have you on to talk about them. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Enjoy BoucherCon.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. Thank you.
Yeah. Go have fun in BoucherCon in St. Louis. You know, I try to say that tongue-in-cheek, in St. Louis. All right. Again, everybody, that was author Johnny Shaw, author of Dove Season. You can find him at johnnyshaw.net. Like he said, you know, talking about his book, it's a rural, you know, rural suspense thriller book, and it's written with a lot of emotional roller coasters going in, which is exactly what you want to have in a suspense thriller book. Make sure you check it out here on Amazon, you know, Barnes & Noble, places where you can find, you know, wherever you go and find your books. Check out his website, johnnyshaw.net. We're going to take a short break. We're going to be back with our next guest here, J.M. LaDuc. And if I said that wrong, it's not a shock. So we will be back to talk with them in a second. See you right back. Right now, ladies and gentlemen, that if you don't like Spandau Ballet and you don't like the song True, I just don't know what's going to get you, because it's just one of those fabulous songs. But it's great to be back, and we're going to be up here with our next guest in just a second, J.M. LaDuc. Again, we had Johnny Shaw on before. And for those of you who are not familiar with you know, events and BoucherCon and fan events, you want to go check around and check them out. Left Coast Crime is a good one, Thriller Fest. You know, BoucherCon, RT, which is Romantic Times, has a good one. And they're all over the country, and they're all around. And it's a place that you can go and meet your favorite author, talk with them, have a beer with them, have a drink with them. you know, and just sit down and just see what's going on, and be able to maybe pick their brain for a half hour. You're not going to get that opportunity anywhere else. So it's something that you should definitely check out and try to make a pilgrimage if you've never done it before. But now we want to bring on our next guest, J.M. LaDuke, with his book, Cursed Blessing. So I want to say welcome, J.M. Thanks so much for joining us. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, and it's a pleasure to be here. So thank you for having me on. It's an honor.
Yeah, so Cursed Blessing, we know it's a trilogy, and I love it when authors tell me, here's the trilogy. So I know there's three books, or I know there's four books or five books, because then I got that buildup of suspense knowing that an ending is coming more often than not than saying, you know, here's another book with the character. But the suspense really isn't there because you don't really feel that there can be an ending coming. Maybe that's why the show 24 was so popular, because you knew when hour 22 hit, the shit was going to really hit the fan, and you got the last 2 hours going to town. So tell us about, you know, Cursed Blessing and, you know, your kind of idea about all of that.
Well, you know, it started out, Cursed Blessing really started out just as an idea, you know. It was, I knew what I wanted to do with the characters, you know, with the protagonist, Brent Venturi, and where he was coming from. You know, he was a broken man coming from a military background, just, you know, psychologically broken and certainly physically scarred, trying to get his life back together and trying to leave the old life behind, and, you know, learns through a series of events that, you know, what you were and what you are and what you're going to be are all the same, and just it's impossible to leave that life behind, but you can certainly make it, you know, help you be a better person and, you know, get on with things in the future. But Cursed Blessing started out truthfully as I've always had, you know, this infatuation with Ark of the Covenant. And so when I started looking about subjects to write on, of course, that was one of the things that came to my mind, but there are just so many things out there on the Ark of the Covenant. And, you know, whether it be fictional or, you know, or true or, you know, theory, it's just, so I just tried to find a different avenue. And as I started writing what ended up to be Cursed Blessing, I started thinking about, well, what if there was more than one arc? You know, what if there were three that were originally made? And that's how the trilogy came out. You know, it was that each book covers a different arc. The first one covers what's called the Arc of the Endowment and the secrets that it holds. And the second one that will be out November or December, which will be Cursed Presence, will cover the Arc of the Enlightenment. And again, and the secrets and the horrors that are held inside that arc. And then we'll finally get into the third book of the trilogy, which will then, you know, talk about, you know, we'll get into the Ark of the Covenant. And you know, each of the books are based on a slightly, a bit of a biblical truth. And, but, you know, the best part about being, you know, a fictional author and a thriller author is that you can take a little bit of the truth and twist it any way you want. And you know, hopefully I think I've twisted it in a very interesting and suspenseful way.
Now, so you have to be a fan then, of course, of Raiders of the Lost Ark. I mean, without a doubt. It's got to be one of your favorite movies about the Ark of the Covenant.
Absolutely.
And you're right. It is one of those, I guess, when you look at the historical fiction, and, you know, when you're talking about historical things like that, yours is not really, I guess, you know, would you label it a historical fiction book, or maybe more just like a suspenseful thing with historical background?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't consider it a historical fiction at all. You know, I mean, there's a tiny bit of historical background that plays into, you know, into the suspense, but it's really a suspense thriller that that has as its backdrop this bit of, you know, of history, but it's by no means a historical fiction.
And so when going into that, when you're telling people, you know, Ark of the Covenant and things of that nature, and it's not really the historical thing, but you're bringing those kinds of elements into it, I always like to ask, did you find something out that you didn't know about, like, the Ark of the Covenant, since there's really not a lot of books written about it in the sense, in the fictional setting? Did you find anything interesting out that you were able to turn into the story that you didn't know before you were writing it?
I did, you know, and we're almost kind of jumping ahead because the things that I found out we won't actually read about until we get into the third book of the trilogy. But it's, I found out a lot of interesting things that I absolutely had no idea about. You know, it was just one of those subjects that, you know, that interested me, that, you know, that I enjoyed reading about. And when Curse Blessing was first conceived, it was, I really had no idea where it was going. You know, it was like I knew who the characters were when I started writing it, and where their situation was going to start out at. And it was a very fluid experience. You know, as I wrote, the ending started to come to me, and now I had to fill in all the gaps. And so it was a process of certainly elimination. You know, I would write for 200 pages and then realize, you know what, this isn't the direction I want to go in, and I'd end up, you know, eliminating a good part of those 200 pages and starting over again. And in turn, you know, number one, I think it certainly made a better story, and secondly, hopefully it made me a better writer. So I'm just not one of those people that can sit there and outline and then write from an outline. It has to come. It just comes as I write. You know, the words come as they're put down on paper, and literally put down on paper. You know, when I wrote Curse Blessing, my imagination just wouldn't work on a keyboard. So the whole thing was handwritten before it was put onto the word processor. So. My imagination works a lot better with a pen in hand and a paper in front of me. So
now, when you were conceiving the trilogy, was it fair to say that basically, if you put all the books together, it's 1,000, and let's just say it's 1,000-page story that you decide to cut into three to kind of leave the cliffhanger between book one and two? Do you suggest that when the trilogy's out, that people start here at the first book, Curse Blessing, and go onward? Or when the trilogy's out, is it something that they can read standalone? How did you write this?
Well, I wrote it purposely to make sure that they were standalone. You know, there's nothing worse than picking up a book and that might be a second or third in the series and having absolutely no idea what they're talking about. You know, and realizing that you've got to go back from the beginning if you want to understand what it is that you're trying to read. So I wanted something that certainly flowed from book one to two to three, but at the same time, I wanted to make sure that if somebody, you know, if book two grabbed somebody's attention, that they could pick it up and it would make sense. So, you know, the background is always there, written into the story from whatever happened in the book before or the books before. But at the same time, you know, does it make a better story if you go back from book one and read from there? I think with any series or trilogy that it does, but I purposely made sure that each book could be read as a standalone novel.
Now, my producer told me before you came on that J.M. LeDuc, which I knew, was not your real name, but there's an interesting little story behind why you picked J.M., I guess, LeDuc to sort of write under. Can you kind of get into that with us?
Yeah, absolutely. My real name is, you know, it's Mark Aducci, and my mother's maiden name was Judith LeDuc, Judith Marie LeDuc. And, truthfully, she passed away in December of 2001, such a passion for the written word. And even from my earliest days, I can always remember her you know, if she wasn't writing, she was reading, and that passion was passed on to me. So, you know, just in her memory, I wanted to write under her name and keep her name alive, and at the same time, you know, keep that passion burning within myself. So that was the reason I decided to write under a pseudonym and you know, specifically under her name.
So when you decided to put pen to paper, your journey, you know, very emotionally charged from the beginning, and, you know, when you sat down and started to write, you know, Curse Blessing and the trilogy, was, you know, that kind of emotion kind of, you know, charging you to move forward when the times were tough, when it's difficult to get through and you just can't break through? You know, how did you handle those situations?
Well, I think every writer just hits those kind of stumbling blocks in a storyline where they're not sure where they're going to go or, you know, where the emotion should lead. And, it, you know, it certainly helped me just to, you know, if I'd look up at the top of the page and see that name, it would certainly just, it would help push me on, you know, the emotion that that I knew my mother had for writing. But at the same time, it was when you hit those stumbling blocks, I think every writer has a different method of trying to get through them or, you know, how they get over them. For me, it was always going back to an earlier part of the story and either in rereading and deciding whether is this really the way I want the story to go, you know, and why, if this is the way I want it to go, why am I hitting this stumbling block? And a lot of times I found that, you know what, I need to change the direction here. So I would go back and rewrite part of what I had already written in order to find a detour or a different way around that stumbling block. You know, and that's how a lot of times that subplots end up being written. You know that what your main storyline is. In my case, a lot of the subplots were certainly not pre-written in any way, whether in my mind or any other way. And they came along as stumbling blocks came along in the writing, you know, just like traveling along a road. You know, you find you can't go from A to B, so you got to go from, you know, A to C to D to F back to B again. And
right.
that was how the subplots came about, by hitting those little, you know, stumbling blocks. But each one, you know, really did become a cursed blessing, you know, in a way, that, you know, it's a curse because it's frustrating at times, but it's certainly a blessing because it makes, it makes for a better story, and it makes for, you know, certainly, hopefully a much better read.
Now, you know, this is a, and now how many, or what I'm trying to say is that, where's the best way, because I know you're in a transition stage, kind of with your website, your things that are going on. What is the best way if people want to interact, if they want to, you know about things and, you know, ask questions or things of that nature about the book Curse Blessing? Where can they kind of find out more information? You have a blog that you're doing or something like that people can follow?
I am. I just started a new blog at jmleduc.blogspot.com. And they can certainly, you know, follow me and my writing process and aspects of my life through that website. And anybody that has any comments, anybody that's, you know, that's read the book that wants that has opinions on it, I would certainly love to hear from everybody, you know, good, bad, or indifferent. You know, every comment makes you stronger and makes you a better writer. And you can always reach me at jmleduc@yahoo.com. So, yeah, either way, you know, certainly the blog is a great way just to, you know, kind of with a voyeuristic style, just kind of tag on into my life a little bit and then certainly comment. But it's, yeah, so that would be the two easiest avenues to get in touch with me and stay in touch.
Looking back, kind of, you know, when you decided to either start writing, what was that one thing that kind of pushed you to go ahead and start putting, you know, pen to paper and decide this is what I want to do, because writing is not your full-time job. You know, you have another job that you do, and, you know, writing is something that you do on the side. Am I correct?
Yes, very much.
Yeah. So when was that first kind of thing that kind of hit you in the face that you just said, I got to start getting this down? Was there kind of that epiphany that you had?
There was. You know, in my life, it was a transition point. You know, I had always been very active, and, you know, the crazier the better as far as the things that I enjoyed doing, whether it was, skydiving, or I did some, you know, deep cave scuba diving and some survival training as far as, you know, survival races, 3, 4, 5 day survival races, where basically you're given a compass, a map, and, you know, you're told to go. And along the way, you would either find your bike that was waiting for you for the next trek, or whether it be a canoe or, you know, climbing gear, and all of a sudden you had to strap up and, you know, and start to climb up, you know, the side of a mountain and rappel down the other side, or whatever it might be. But it was for whatever I could find for this adrenaline rush, I would love. I spent a couple of years riding bulls and bareback on the radio circuit out in Colorado and Wyoming, and then it kind of all just came to an end. 1997, I had a bilateral hip replacement. And partially because of some of the things that I did, and partially just I had a congenital issue that I was born with. And so because of things of this nature, I had all this pent-up, I don't want to say aggression, but just this adventure inside me that I wanted to get out. And I had always loved writing, you know, as a child and certainly as a young adult. And so now I found a new outlet for this adventure, for this adrenaline, and that was through the written word. And that's when I really started to write seriously, and eventually through you know, writing different short things, Curse Blessing came about. And you know, it's been quite an adventure, from certainly the putting the first word down until. Certainly to being published, but it's been a great adventure. Probably one of the greatest of my life, and one of the most difficult in some ways, but in other ways certainly one of the most rewarding.
Now, a lot of people, you know, when you write the first one, a lot of people always like to know, because books are one of those things that they're always cliffhangers. Whether the book ends, it's still a cliffhanger, because people always want the next one from the author, especially if they loved it. So when is book two coming out for you here in the trilogy of The Chosen?
The book two, which is will be titled Cursed Presence, will be out end of November, December. So it won't be long. There won't be a big, you know, delay between book one and book two, which is great. You know, I'm thrilled that the publisher has agreed to do that, and so that to me is wonderful, because, you know, when you read the first book in a series and then you're sitting there waiting for a year, year and a half for that second one to come out, it becomes frustrating, you know, and a lot of times you end up having to go back and kind of reread a little bit because you forgot what it is that you loved about the first one to begin with. So I'm thrilled that the publisher has agreed to do so, and, you know, it's an honor that it's coming out as fast as it is.
Yeah, we're going to have to email over to the publisher and get like a hard date down to figure out when that book's coming out. I'm going to have to get up on that one.
Yeah, I don't have the exact date. I just know that it was going to be about 3 months from the time the first one was published. And first one came out August 29th. So, you know, move ahead 3 months. We're looking at the end of November. So.
Now, and so, kind of to wrap things up, and, you know, we were kind of running out of time. We just kind of kept going, and it was like, oh, my God, you know, time's almost up. But a lot of people always like to know, because the big question is marketing and things like that. You know, how do you market? How do you do it? You know, what do you do? What are you doing that even might be outside your comfort zone that you didn't, you know, that you're having to do in order to get the word out there for Curse Blessing, you know, besides, you know, doing a blog and maybe you know, radio show and things like that. Have you, what was your game plan kind of coming in, or did you really have one?
As far as the game plan was concerned, you know, because Curse Blessing is coming out or came out as an ebook, it's a lot of it is taking place through electronic media, you know, through the social sites, through you know, Goodreads, and through certainly Facebook and you know, Twitter and things of that nature. But I'm also luckily, there's some great independent bookstores down here in South Florida that still, you know, that even though they are, you know, book and mortar stores, have realized that where the future of writing is going and publishing. And so we have, we are setting up some events in some of these stores to get the word out. And so I'm really looking forward to, you know, to getting out there and talking about Curse Blessing and the, certainly the adventure that that I went on to write it and to get the story out there. You know, I just I'm proud of what's been written, and I'm really looking forward to hearing from the readers and what they have to say.
And you know, seeing as how ebooks are kind of bam, 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 and you got another one coming out, you're almost looking at this as a rock band. Who kind of tours and has to keep going, you know, for like a year, because all of a sudden, you know, Curse Presence is going to come out and people are going to want to talk to you about that. And so you're going to have to be switching gears, and then your third book's going to come out. So it's you're going to be kind of on the marketing circuit here for a little while. So that's going to be exciting for you, something different.
It's really exciting. You know, and in fact, what, you know, when you said tour, it reminded me that, you know, certainly we're also involved in putting together a blog tour, you know, through other bloggers,
yeah,
sites, which is great, and it gets, you know, it allows us to get some promotion and get to know readers that we may not have been able to reach before, because, you know, every blogger has their, you know, their genre or their, you know, their niche of different readers that that they attract. So it's wonderful that we're allowed to, you know, to guest blog on other blogger sites. So I really think that's going to be a big part of the marketing also. But, yeah, I love the fact that the books are coming out, you know, bam, 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 you know, because of the fact that it's just, you know, it does keep, you know, keeps me certainly on my toes and keeps me, you know, working hard and keeps that promotion going. But at the same time, I just think it's great for the reader. You know, there's nothing better than to be able to, you know, if you like what you're reading, be able to pick up that second book, you know, fairly shortly afterward and continue, you know, continue that ride. So it's,
So, well, Mark, the music's coming on. Producer's telling us we are out of time. We are so happy, J.M. LeDuc, to talk to you about A Cursed Blessing. Wish you nothing but success. Can't wait to have you back on, because we'll have you back on here for Cursed Presence, like we said, at the end of the year, and see how, you know, the train is rolling. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been, you know, it's a pleasure and it's an honor, and I can't thank you enough. So just,
well,
you know, everybody, that's yeah, absolutely. You have a great day.
All right. You have a good one.
Thank you.
So everybody, that is J.M. DeLuc, author of Curse Blessing. You can find it wherever ebooks are sold. Go look for Curse Blessing, the first book in the trilogy here of The Chosen. Great author, great book. We had Johnny Shaw on talking about Dove Seas. You can find him at johnnyshaw.net and find out his book. You want the September magazine, you want the October magazine, then email editor@suspensemagazine.com, and we'll send out your four free issues. Until then, we will see you all when we come back. Check Facebook, and we'll let you know on the schedule when our next show is going to be. I believe it's going to be October 1st or September 24th, and we will talk to you then. Have a good day, everybody.